The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 21st, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Thanks for coming out on this cool morning here in Dharma Field. It's nice to see you. Leslie's just going to warm up today. So we do have a solstice sitting this evening if people are interested. It's a fun event, and we'll have candles in the middle of the room, and we'll be sitting meditation to candlelight, and then we're going to have a little fire and back afterwards and have s'mores and hot cider. And it is going to warm up, so please do show up for that event. And I'm going to talk about, at risk of wearing out the topic, I'm going to talk about the winter solstice for my talk this morning. And, you know, winter solstice is it's kind of interesting if you think about it. It's either the shortest day or it's the longest night, right, of the year. So the shortest day or longest night of the year. And the thing about thinking of it in those terms is, well, one of them is not necessarily true. The other is not necessarily false, if that makes any sense. So whether this is the longest day, I mean, the longest night or the shortest day, neither one of them are exactly true. They don't really get at what it is that's going on here. And then when we think about something like that, whether something is true or false, or worse, the fact that things aren't true or false, can throw us into confusion a little bit. Excuse me. And maybe not so much about the winter solstice. You probably don't struggle with that. But when you start getting into other questions that really are kind of set up the same way, and they have that, well, neither one is really true or neither one is really false quality to it, it can be a little disconcerting. It can be a little bit like that itch that you get in the middle of your back that you can't quite get at, you know. So recently, Steve's been bringing up this one a lot. And it's a good one because I was witness once to, I had invited Steve to join a friend of mine for dinner because I thought my friend and Steve would hit it off. And my friend had just read Steve Hagen's book, The Grand Delusion. And so he had a question about this, you know, Leibniz. So Steve is, we'll quote this philosopher, mathematician, polymath, really, Gottfried Leibniz, who asked, why is there something rather than nothing? Right? And Steve's reply to that is, well, we don't really have something, but we can't say that there's nothing. And that was the thing that my friend, I could just see him trying to figure that out. He goes, well, I don't understand what you're saying there. Steve, of course, couldn't quite articulate that. But it's that kind of thing, right? We can't say there's something here, but we can't say there's nothing. That's the kind of thing. Not is this the shortest day or the longest night, but is there something here or isn't there something here? And that one is a weird one because, I mean, I just think about, you know, being a child. And I know I mentioned this in my talks, being a child. But when I was a child, there was this period in my life when I was really wrestling with these questions. I was pretty young. And I did wonder why this stuff was here. That was kind of, I mean, I don't know how to put it, but I was like, why am I here? Why is that tree here? Why is, you know, and it, sometimes it'd show up in, why am I in America? Why am I in, and I was living in a town called Kaukauna. Why am I in Kaukauna, Wisconsin? Why am I not poor? You know, why am I, you know, all these questions about this. And, the reason that those questions are so aggravating is the way that it's put together, the way that we understand it, the way that perhaps our parents keep trying to explain it to us. It doesn't make any sense because it's almost like they're saying, well, really that it's the shortest day is the right way to look at it and the longest night is not. And sometimes they'll say that. And then sometimes they'll say, really, it's the longest night that makes sense. And the shortest day doesn't really capture, you know, And it seems like they kind of would move back and forth on this stuff. The deal with these terms, what we're seeing about them, is that not only are, you know, shortest day and longest night not mutually exclusive, but they actually depend on each other, right, in order for this to even make any sense. Short day, long night, They kind of go together. You can't have one without the other. So they completely depend on each other. And this is the nature of all binary oppositions. All oppositions have this quality where they completely depend on that other, the opposition, right? So hot and cold, day and night, light and dark, good and bad, right and wrong. All of this depends, each of them depend on the other in order to make any sense whatsoever. And even then, and I'll go into this a little bit more detail later in my talk, but even then, what are we talking about when we're talking about hot and cold? You know, for example, I just think about cold, and I think, you know, on a hot summer day, so now I'm putting hot in there, but let's just say, we'll just bring our fond memories back to when it was 90 degrees and maybe a tad bit on the humid side, and we pour a glass of tap water. And you know that thing where you put your finger under the water to make sure it's cool, right? As soon as you turn a tap on in 90 degree weather, it's cool, you know? Whereas in the winter, if you have a drafty house or like our Zendo, and I do apologize, our furnace seems to be kind of going on and off right now, but when you put your hand under what would be cold water in the summer, in the winter, it feels kind of warm. That's the way it feels. So that it's completely relative. Is that warm water or is that cold water? Well, it depends. Depends on the conditions, the situation in which it's situated, right? And so the binary oppositions each contain the other, and then they actually depend on other things that they're in opposition with as well. And it's this way that these binary opposites are actually expressing truth, reality, or the absolute, or what we might call oneness. If you think about that, if you see something and it depends on this other thing in order for this thing to be what it is, it needs this to be here. So if we just sort of look at it, we usually just look at this thing, and then we think we understand what it is. It's an opposition to things that might not even be there, but they're still there, right? It needs that opposition to show up. It needs that other thing to appear. And those things need other things as well to appear. And in doing that, you start to see it's going to include everything. So it's in that interdependence, a complete dependence of each thing on something else, that absolute truth is expressing itself. It's expressing itself just like that. And absolute truth is that truth that's boundless. Absolute truth is a truth you can't really say anything about. Why can't you say anything about it? Well, it's different from, I didn't say moment to moment, but even more than that, it's more than moment to moment. It's just you can't. We had a senior teacher here who described reality. He made up a word, and it's a good word, unpindownable. That's what he said. And the reason why is it shows up like this showing up and that's going away. This is showing up and that's going away. Right? I had a professor in graduate school who is a theater director, and he would talk about how theater was predicated on disappearance. And at first, I didn't really know what he was talking about. But that's what he's talking about. You can't, without whatever it is that's happening right now going away, you don't have a live show on your hands. Do you know what I mean? It has to just continually be something showing up and disappearing and showing up, disappearing and showing up, disappearing. And he was so rooted in his belief that that was the dynamo, the engine that drove theater, that he didn't want pictures of his productions taken. Because he said, no, the theater is in the live event that's disappearing. You take a picture of it, you're changing it, right? And I knew him as an older man, and I will say he regretted that. He was like, oh, I wish I had more pictures of my productions, but I was really adamant that theater was about disappearance, which it is, but that doesn't mean you can't take pictures. So I say that now, that there's this thorough interdependence, right, between the thing and its opposite, day and night, light and dark. And yet, that doesn't mean that we can throw those differences out. So we know night is night and day is day. And yet, like we start looking even closely at something where we go, yep, we know night is night and day is day. If we're really paying attention, we start to see that it's harder to distinguish that than we think. And I just think about something like twilight. If you think about twilight, it becomes hard to tell exactly. And there are two versions of twilight, right? There's dawn and there's dusk. And one of them is like, well, the day's coming, the day's starting. And the other one is the day's ending. And they're shot through with ideas of night and day. And I remember I never napped when I was a young man. Kind of wish I had that ability now, because now I'm like, it gets to be about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. I'm like, oh my goodness, how am I gonna make it without falling asleep right now? But back then, I almost never fell asleep. I would say it was very rare. And I remember I laid down on my couch to read a book, and the next thing I knew, I woke up. And I was looking around and I had no idea where I was. I had no idea who I was. I had no idea what had just happened. So it took a little while for that. I went, oh, I fell asleep. And then I thought, what am I doing on the couch? And then the picture started to clarify. And I had no idea when I looked at the clock that said 6:30, based on the light outside, I was like, AM or PM? Like, I didn't know if I had to be running to get ready for work or what was going on. So it took me a while to kind of figure that out. It's sort of hard. And if you've ever, watched the sunrise, when exactly that happens, unless you're in very optimum situation, that's kind of hard to tell. Same thing with the sunset. So at my husband's family's cabin, every evening there's a ritual, unless it's raining or something. They go down to the dock and they sit on the dock and they watch the sunset, And I do that too. It's really beautiful. But there are clouds that get on the horizon and you can't ever really see, you know what I mean? You see it going down behind a cloud. Did the sun go down yet? Did the sun go down yet? So even those things we think are, we have set, we don't really have set. And then when we're talking about day and night, we're not always just talking about the sun being up and, the sun being down. So we're talking about the day, maybe the day's starting. So is 4 a.m. day or night? Is it day or night? And I've actually had silly debates about that. Is it day or night? And I was reminded when I was writing that, if you remember the movie Gremlins. Yeah, it's a classic. And Gremlins was, the premise of Gremlins were these cute little things called Mogwai. And they were like a cross between a troll doll and a teddy bear. But they were alive and then they cooed like babies, basically. And the person who got this Mogwai was given 3 rules, very stern rules. Don't expose the Mogwai to bright light. Don't get it wet. And whatever you do, and I remember this one, whatever you do, don't feed it after midnight. And I remember thinking, well, isn't every moment after midnight? I mean, what are you talking about after midnight? You need to put a parameter on that? Wouldn't 11:59 p.m. be after midnight? Some way of looking at it, right? So, but that's the thing. We don't really think too much about that. Maybe with Gremlins you thought about that. But usually, you just kind of use these terms and you're not thinking about how they're not as coherent as you think they are. And the same thing is with breathing. So I've been teaching the Eightfold Path here at Dharma Field, and we just raced through talking about meditation. And one of the things that I point out with meditation is, we're paying attention to our breath. We pay attention to our breath as it goes in, as it goes out, and we know what that's called, inhalation and exhalation. And we know when we're inhaling and we know when we're exhaling. So getting back to those binary oppositions, you never are exhaling and go, yep, I'm actually inhaling right now. You know what I mean? Like, they're different. You know that they're different. And yet, when you sit in meditation and you're really paying attention, you realize, I'm going to say there's a point, but I'm really hesitant to call it a point because it's not exactly a point. But there is a realization that you don't know whether you're inhaling or exhaling. And when I first started meditating, it was described as a point. In fact, and I'm not telling you to do this, I'm just saying I read this. They were saying, oh yeah, this is direct yourself to the gap between inhalation and exhalation. Put yourself right there in that gap. And that's where boundlessness is. And like I said, I don't recommend that because what I realized, I didn't do that because I didn't know what they're talking about, right? But when I finally started realizing it, I realized it wasn't a gap. It was just the complete indeterminacy of inhalation or exhalation. So it's not like you inhale and then there's a gap and then you exhale and there's a gap and then you inhale and then there's a gap. There's just a, it's a continual flowing. And at some point you can't tell. Am I still exhaling here? Inhaling now. It doesn't feel like I'm doing either one right now. And it's all part of the same continuum. It's the same thing. What we realize is that even in things that seem like it's irrefutable, it's really hard for us to make that distinction when we look closely, when we really look closely at what's going on, which again doesn't mean there's not inhalation, not exhalation. It's like walking. It's like walking. So on Thursday mornings, we've been reading Shito's Merging of Difference and Unity, and then commentary on that by the 20th century Zen master Shunryu Suzuki. And he brings up Shito, this ancient Chinese teacher, brings up walking as a way to think about these binary oppositions and how they don't, that each term doesn't have a solid reality. He says like forward and backward foot, right? He says light and dark oppose one another like front and back foot in walking. Yeah, it's the same thing. You can't have a front foot unless there's a back foot. But what is the back foot? Because if you're walking, right, this is where my theater teacher was, you know, talking about theater, it's art of disappearance. Well, that back foot is sometimes the front foot, and sometimes it's the back foot, sometimes it's the front foot. You could never say my left foot is the front foot, because sometimes the left foot is the front foot, and sometimes the right foot is, you know, that's walking. That's how walking works. You need one to be the other. And again, that is absolute expressing itself. Totality or the absolute or reality, whatever you want to call it. I think reality sometimes is the easiest way for us to hear this. No, it actually is absolute in that reality is absolute truth and that it's undeniable. It's the thing you can't deny. It's a thing you can't debate with. We can debate with a whole lot of stuff, but the thing you can't debate with is reality. What is reality? Well, it's just this. It's just this. And so reality is always expressing itself. It's always expressing what we call dharma, truth of reality, right? It's always expressing. It can't help but do that, right? It's just, here we are. No matter what happens, that's reality. And there's another way. So one of the ways that reality expresses itself is in this complete dependence. Well, I'm going to flip that around a little bit. And it's also in the complete uniqueness of everything that reality is also, or the absolute is also expressing itself. Because no matter what you have, just thinking of some fun thing to hold up. Oh, I do have a fun thing. It was a gift from a friend from a long time ago. She didn't even remember that she gave it to me because it was a keychain. You know how you get keychains and they're, a lot of times they're like from a car dealership or something like that and they're just kind of ugly and then there are those weird discs where you have to slide things on or whatever. She gave me this adorable monkey hanging on a branch. And you just kind of pop it open. It's a problem sometimes because it pops open and keys go flying all over the place. But it's adorable. So I've kept it all these years. And I even was getting a copy of a key made once in the locksmith said, "Oh, that keychain." He goes, "I could sell that. You want to sell it to me?" And I said, "No, I don't actually." But so there's nothing else that's exactly like this, right? There's nothing else that's quite like monkey branch keychain, you know? Even another monkey branch keychain wouldn't be exactly like this, right? Everything is absolutely unique. Even if it kind of resembles something else, it's never quite, that other thing isn't quite like the thing you're comparing it with. Otherwise, you wouldn't have two things, right? So they can't be that way. So you could say, there's another monkey on a branch keychain, but it doesn't have a little hole in the shoulder of the monkey. That one doesn't have a little hole in the shoulder. Or this pop, this cola tastes the same as your cola, except maybe it's not as sweet, or maybe it's not as fizzy. You know, this is just like that, but it's a little warmer. Everything's just a little bit different. There's nothing else like this. And this is the nature of reality too. Nothing like it. Nothing like it. I remember reading a powerful poem by Laura Jackson Riding. Is it Riding Jackson or Jackson Riding? It is one of those two. But she was writing about death. And she said, like it's trying to come up with a simile to help people understand death. She says, like this, like nothing else. I remember when I read that, I just went, ah. And then I thought, but that's true of just everything. It's like this. It's like this. It's like nothing else. And in that way, everything we encounter that's just like it is also expressing reality. And because it has that quality to it, we have a tendency to mistake what we're seeing. And we think then that the world is filled with a whole bunch of this and that, losing sight of that dependence that each object has on everything else in order to be that object, right? So we overlook the absolute nature. We overlook how it is that the uniqueness of each object is expressing the absolute, right? Which isn't to get rid of the differences. I hope that's clear. You know, I'm not trying to say that because they're all expressing oneness or the absolute or reality that there aren't these differences. There are differences. And when we're talking about the differences between, say, a monkey hanging from a branch keychain and another monkey hanging from a branch keychain, that might not matter to us so much. But it matters to us, and it really starts to cause problems for us when we think about good and bad or right and wrong, because those terms are binary oppositions as well. They depend on the other as well. They don't have any more solidity than anything else that we can point to. They don't have any more reality. And then it sounds like what we're doing is we're saying there isn't good or bad, there isn't right or wrong, which isn't what I'm necessarily saying, but I could say there is absolutely not good and there is absolutely not bad. Because reality is just reality. Whether we call it good or bad doesn't matter. We could say reality doesn't care. You can call it whatever you want to call it. Reality is just going to be reality, right? And even, and again, this can be tricky because there's stuff we could point to and go, that, we would all agree that action is bad. Or we would all agree that the way that I heard somebody put it once was, it is objectively bad. Objectively bad. And it is objectively bad, except that because it's objectively bad, then it really is, we all agree. And it requires that agreement to it because it is in the world of objects. And now you've got, you're sort of blotting out the totality of the experience. So now you've got debate that's going on. You know, I hear people defending things that are going on right now where I'm startled that I'm hearing somebody defend it. And yet when I hear them defend it, I'm not saying I'm persuaded by it, but I hear the logic behind it. You know what I mean? And it becomes contestable, right? It becomes arguable. Reality is inarguable. It's incontestable. It is just experience. That is the truth of reality. It's just experience. You can't deny that. Now, I don't know what Shirley's experiencing at this moment. It's not the same thing I am, but she's experienced. She experienced something, right? There's experience showing up. That is incontestable. Shito and Merging of Difference and Unity tells us, within light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. Within darkness there is light, but don't see it as light, right? We can see light or darkness, first of all, and see that neither of them is purely light or purely darkness. And yet he's also telling us, don't even think of them in those terms. Let those terms go. So again, does that mean throw light or dark away? No. But he's trying to help you to see that those terms are completely dependent on the conditions in which they're showing up. They're completely dependent on that. I kind of looked over the section in Shinryu Suzuki's book where he talked about that. And he said, you know, we're sitting in this meditation hall at Tassajara, this monastery that's south of San Francisco. He said, we're sitting here, and it seems like it's kind of bright in here today. He said, but somebody who just outside steps in, it's going to be really dark in here, you know. So again, it's not... It really depends on the conditions, these kinds of ways that we have of understanding reality. Reality is just showing up, you know? So it's showing up that way. We don't have to give it that name. We don't have to buy into that. If we can do that with good or bad or right or wrong, then perhaps we can avoid the notion of God is on our side. Or if you're not subscribing to God, rightness or justice is on my side. Because when we do that, if we can do that, if we can allow ourselves a place where we're not inviting that kind of goods on my side, bads on that side, then we're actually going to allow compassion to enter. We allow compassion to enter by not taking those binary oppositions, grabbing one, saying this is the truth, that other one's not true. Good or bad, right or wrong, we can experience the suffering of all sentient beings. And that's all sentient beings, so it's not their suffering, it's not my suffering, it's just suffering. The good suffer, the bad suffer. It's letting that in. And that's hard for us to hear when we overlook the interdependent nature of things. Then maybe we do start fighting about whether it is the shortest day or the longest night. But whichever it is, it's always this. Here, now. Here, now. And this is clarity, this is wisdom, and this is compassion. That's my solstice talk. Do people have any observations or questions or just anything you want to talk about this morning? You know, thinking about the solstice. I don't know if people still experience this. I don't hear this as much as I used to, but people used to be like, oh, I can't wait for winter to be done. And this seemed to be that point where, now it's going to be in the rearview mirror. But I did hear, just for those of you for whom that's how you might treat solstice, I heard a meteorologist talking about how little sunlight we will be gaining in the next 2 weeks. So it's just seconds per day. So I suppose if you need to hang on to something, there is that. So, but there's that space. You know, is it really getting longer days? It's shorter nights.
You can always. It feels perfect. And then I was also really,
just thinking about like in here.
I also used to stay up and watch Stonehenge, because at Stonehenge they have a big thing about the solstice there too. And when I went over to Europe, I wasn't at solstice, but I was able to go to Stonehenge. And my brother that I was traveling with, he was like, come on, let's go. And it's like, no, this is Stonehenge. So it connects with solstice to me. And
yeah,
I don't know, something about the return of the light is cool.
Yeah. So you went to Stonehenge. Were you kept from a distance, a pretty far distance? Yeah, by the time I got there, there's a path that went around it, but yeah, there was some distance between me and that. So there were these other rocks that weren't aligned to the sunlight, the moonlight, the way Stonehenge is. There were the Avesbury rocks, and they're right along the roads. And those things are right there, and they had a life to them. I just watched Spinal Tap 2 last night, actually, speaking of Stonehenge. Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Thanks for your talk, Steve. And it's always very challenging, and maybe I don't need to explain this, but it was really helpful for me this morning, because when a person has sort of a aha moment of understanding, that's really hard to articulate, I think. So I'll try to do that. But what your words helped me to get a little more clarity around is, I think from a lot of my life and seeking for this balance point, right, in between the paradox of light and dark, has always been me wanting to figure out how to be in that middle way place, because that's the good stuff, right? That's the gem, that's the joy, that's the enlightenment, or whatever words you want to put around that. And just listening to your words this morning helped me to realize that place can't be found without always having those places as reference points, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So thank you. That was really helpful for me to get a little bit more clarity around how it's like a trinity sort of that needs to be there constantly. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know, just hearing you say that, one of the things that strikes me is that equilibrium point then becomes another thing that's as opposed to the non-equilibrium point. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that, then it becomes another thing. And once it becomes another thing, then it has that same quality that all the things that are opposed to one another has, which is that it's never really quite right. You know, it's always shot through with its opposition. So that point of equilibrium is always that one, the one that you can shoot for. And this is why I think that aiming for the gap in your meditation and your breath or whatever is not helpful, because I think it's aiming for something. And the practice here is just, if we're aiming for anything at all, it's to not aim at anything, you know, and then you're dead on. That makes sense. And we just talked about this in Steve's book too. He talks about the reverse bullseye or whatever it is. So, you know, the bullseye is the most points. And so you go shooting for that, you know, but in this practice, he said, think of the bullseye as 0 points, you know, and you don't aim for it at all. And it's in not aiming for it that we realize it. That's right effort, right? That's this natural effort that doesn't, it's not our usual way of doing things, where we set up a goal. We set up some kind of point, and then it's opposed to other things. It's the non-goal then, right? And then we strive to get it. So yeah, I appreciate your sharing that. That's helpful. Anything else? All right, one last thing before I leave. Just a little announcement. I just want to congratulate. So for the past week now, Steve Hagen has been working with a couple of the priests here at Dharma Field, Bo Elkington and Jed Larson, and they both received Dharma transmission in the past week. So I want to congratulate Jed, who's here, and Bo. I don't know if you're online, but anyhow, congratulations to both of you. If you don't know what Dharma transmission is, it's it's authentic. It's like authentication from Steve that they are teachers, right? It's his stamp of approval. He says they understand these teachings. And sometimes described as face-to-face transmission, and I used to think that was faces looking at each other. And then I realized, no, it's face-to-face student and teacher looking out the same eyes, that they see the same thing. So it doesn't mean anything mystical, right? Nothing was given secretly from, you know, Steve to, well, they did get these certificates. I don't know how secret they are, you know, just sort of acknowledging that the ceremony occurred. But otherwise, it's not, that's not what it's about. It's Dharma transmission. And Dharma, like I said, Dharma is always being expressed. Reality is always expressing it. It's always, you could say, transmitting it. And so Dharma transmission is just, Jed is aware of, you know, transmitting. I don't know how to put it. That's not quite what I want to say. But he's in line with the transmission of the Dharma, right? But he's a human, so he's going to be like all of us. I mean, I know I'm working with this. Sometimes it's flowing nice and good, and sometimes it ain't flowing so nice and good. And that's an opportunity for me to see what's going on. And I see some eddies in the water. What's there? Pay attention, right? And be with that. So anyhow, I'm really happy for the both of you, and congratulations. So what this means on a daily basis, for those of you who sit here at Dharma Field, first of all, Jed will, at some point, he'll be wearing a brown rakusu. He hasn't quite finished sewing his rakusu yet. He didn't have the fortune that I did. I gave my sewing crew, I mean, they weren't my sewing crew. I was just sewing, and I was sewing with these other people, and suddenly a crew had to sew with me because I gave them such a short deadline. I didn't really realize I did that, but I did. So at some point, all these people were sewing my stuff, and one person just sewed this for me. So I had the fortune. The only thing I had to sew is there's this little, just to let you guys know, we all sign our rakusus, and we sign them with these peculiar stitches. It's called a pine stitch on the back of our robes. So if you want to kind of look at that, they'll look very similar to you. But again, like I was talking about with not quite, you know, not exactly the same. That's how the pine stitches would be. Every person's pine stitch is unique to that person. And every time you do it, it'll be unique as well. But anyhow, so Jed will be wearing brown now, as will Bo. And then they'll be sitting up on this wall. There'll be brown cushions here for both of them. And then they will be exiting with the teachers when the bells ring. So just for those of you who are here every day, it'll look a little bit different. So when you see a whole throng of people exiting, it's just we have more Dharma transmitted teachers here now. So anyway, so congratulate Jed downstairs, and hopefully we'll see a teacher.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.